to another episode of No Gods, No Mayors, the podcast about municipal weirdness. I am November Kelly. I am joined, as always, by my friends Riley Quinn and Matthew Lubchansky.
Hello.
Hello.
And we're here with a really good mayor, a really elegiac mayor, because it's my turn, as we take turns, to decide which mayor we're going to profile. And I've given us T. Dan Smith, the leader of Newcastle City Council from 1965 to 1970, and this is a really Everard Clare-style guy.
Mm. The T stands for the?
It's true, it does. Mm-hmm. The Dan Smith.
The Dan Smith himself?
Mm-hmm. The very Dan Smith. Weirdly, the T. Dan thing comes from this strange little story where he was confused with another Dan Smith in an airport and decided, that's it, I'm done with my name forever.
I'm the Dan Smith.
I'm the Dan Smith now. I'm T. Dan Smith now, so nobody gets me confused with any other normal Dan Smith without a T.
It's like he did the Nicolas Cage thing where he has to have a separate name for mayoring. Like Nicolas Cage has to have a special name for acting.
He's actually a Coppola. People don't know this.
Yeah. There's a lot of Coppolas. There's Coppolas everywhere if you think about it. You ever like get old comedy bits like lodged in your cerebellum? I've got a really old one from that show Super Ego where someone used to do an H.R. Giger impression and someone asks what the H.R. stands for and he just goes, hey, really Giger.
Human resources Giger himself.
That's right.
Is it Giger? Okay. I thought it was Geiger. Anyway,
well, listen.
This guy, T. Dan Smith, I think is a good way to talk about a lot of the kind of post-war English political settlement, such as it was. He's really one of these guys where you can just kind of pull on a thread and there's a lot of stuff there. So I'm really excited to get into that. But before we do, we have a segment that we like to call the segment with four distinct pronunciation notes in it, the Municipal Roundup.
Yeah.
I also, one of the alternative titles I gave it was Esineden Rodeo, because we begin with our first item in Finland.
The item in the Finnish bagging area. Let's go.
Unexpectedly Finnish item in the bagging area. As listener Jethro Q writes in to say, there is a serial mayor in Finland who has been in the news recently because he couldn't stop commenting on thirst traps with inappropriate and largely, unfortunately, untranslatable sexual comments on X the Everything app and Threads.
So I have two questions. Yeah, that's one
Is
of them.
Is horny posting
that's one
on Threads?
Apparently.
Who are you horny posting to? Brands?
Maybe. I would like to fuck the brands, please. Mm-hmm.
But that's also translatable. Like, are there sexual concepts that only the Finnish mind can...
Yes. Only the Finnish mind can conceive of the certain things you say to yum brands.
Have you never dated a Finn? Like, it's an agglutinative language for one thing. So, like, a lot of the words, like, Esineden Rodeo, kind of just, like, stick together. But also, the Finnish spirit is a strange one. And so he's been making untranslatable sexual comments on Elon Musk's X the Everything app and on Threads. His name is
So I have one more question. I'm so sorry. I have one more question. Uh-huh. Do we think it's to all other Finns who will understand, or is it to baffled Swedes?
You know, I'm not sure what the kind of Finnish-Swedish meta is on Threads, you know? And, there are also Swedish-speaking Finns, Tove Jansson, who did the Moomins, for instance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really hard to say. It's very hard to say.
Cartoonist legend, Tove Jansson. Who among us has not seen a woman so hot that our speech is rendered untranslatable?
Speaking
in tongues
often,
on Threads?
Often, very much, very much. His name is Esko Rautiainen, and he's been currently asked to resign from the leadership of Rekula, the fourth municipality he's been head of. And he previously had to resign from the same post at Puolanka for unspecified reasons.
Probably also untranslatable reasons.
Untranslatable reasons. All four municipalities have been all over the map in Finland. This man is a mercenary technocrat.
See, if you're a Northern European and you are cast out of your design firm or civil service job for making untranslatable sexual advances, then you have to do the equivalent of cutting off your top knot, which is you have to get framed glasses. You're not allowed to have rimless glasses.
Do have frames, yes.
Yeah.
Which is like being in Finnish prison.
Sorry, he's a Finnish carpetbagger. He's traveling the nation. Becoming mayor of different. That's incredible. You said serial mayor, and I was like, clearly it's the same place over and over and over.
But
he's riding the rails.
He is. There is also an asterisk on this, which is to say that technically he's not a mayor. He is a municipal leader, because actual mayors are rare. The Finnish word pormestari, from the Swedish pormestare, is literally castle master, is seen as a bit highfalutin for towns of a few thousand. But of course, Helsinki has like 5 co-mayors, of whom one was arrested in 2023 for painting graffiti at a railroad underpass.
We should do a series of 5 episodes that's just all 5 of the Helsinki co-mayors. We are going to be struggling to fill those hours.
The pormestari season.
The mayor was doing graffiti.
Yeah.
This is why apparently. You need after work programs for mayors, so they don't get into trouble.
Mayoral delinquency.
Yeah. Look, excuse me. I'm as an at-risk mayor, I was interested in. The problem is there's the city hall to prison pipeline, and it is something that you have to intervene on so early, like before they even get the sash on.
They're often in the same part of town, so that makes a lot of sense.
To be honest, there is actually a city hall to prison pipeline. Yeah,
that's kind of what the show is.
That's basically what sort we're of here the to show, talk
yeah.
about. Yeah,
yeah,
disgraced mess. But that's my Finnish item.
It's beautiful.
Now, I have a couple of items.
Oh.
I brought one item in because I want to always remember that Municipal Roundup should be a whimsical affair as well as, visiting sort of old friends and people from the news.
Depending on what the untranslatable things were, I think my guy was kind of whimsical with it.
Yeah, I think your guy was absolutely whimsical. We both added a whimsical mayor to kick it all off, and now we have 2 whimsical mayors. So this is Andrea Bianchini, the mayor of Pesaro in Italy, has kicked off a feud with Pavarotti's widow.
Good. Tell me more, please.
Thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, you know what? I made that statement in a way that invited follow-up questions. I'm aware that that's what I've done. Mm-hmm. Andrea Bianchini, the mayor of Pesaro, appeared to aggravate a local issue into a national one by sharing an image of a statue of Luciano Pavarotti, the famous opera singer, in an ice rink alongside the hashtag encouraging skaters to, quote, give Pavarotti a high five.
Is that bad? Should we not be high-fiving Pavarotti?
Well, this has been The Guardian, by the way. Nicoletta Mantovani, Pavarotti's widow, said that in the images, it's clear that the skating rink was built around the statue at about knee height. So it appears
they entombed him in Casitas, like Judas in the Divine Comedy.
No, they gave him the old reverse Ozymandias. It's a legless trunk of bronze. And they put in the statue last year, and then where they were going to build the skating rink. And then they were like, that's fine.
Yeah.
We'll just build the rink around Pavarotti.
My name is Pavarotti, tenor of tenors.
And on the pedestal, these words appear, up high, brother.
And on the pedestal, we have no idea if any words appear because they are covered by a skating rink.
I think maybe Pavarotti's widow is being oversensitive about this. I think you should be allowed to high five the guy.
Is he
too good to high five just because he's dead?
Well, she said it was like a bolt out of the blue. The city should not have allowed something like this because it affects Luciano's image and the respect he deserves. It's just not right.
Why?
Him emerging from the ground does kind of imply that he's in hell a little bit, so I get that.
And also, if he's emerging from the ground in a field of ice, it implies that he's in the very specific kind of hell that Dante imagined Lucifer was in.
Yeah, Casitas. That's the thing I was referencing earlier.
Yes, of course.
He's one of the kind of ice giants, and he's in Niflheim.
Sure. You gotta watch out, because Thor might get you, if that's the case. Mm-hmm.
I'd also like to acknowledge you highbrowed my highbrow reference.
I did.
Went right over my brow.
Hashtag out highbrowed.
Yeah. Hashtag give Pavarotti a high five.
Yeah.
Give Pavarotti a high brow.
Nope.
The mayor told Il Resto del Carlino, there was no intention of disrespect. I was assured that Pavarotti would not be incorporated into the ice rink.
I was told, problem. I was promised he would not be immured.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing. I bet it was a mafia-linked construction company, and they fit Pavarotti for a pair of ice rink shoes.
I can't believe you would disrespect Pavarotti like this by skating around him.
But with the festival due to open in the city's Piazzale Lazzarini this weekend, he said it was no longer possible to dismantle the ice rink.
He's frozen in there. We got to wait until summer, folks.
Yeah, there. As long as there is skating, Pavarotti will be entombed from the knees down.
I will say, thanks to global warming, the Pavarotti thaw does occur every year a little earlier.
Yeah, we're letting ancient Pavarottis that were not accommodated to our immune systems can't handle out of that permafrost.
The permafrost? The parvathrost. No, can't say it. Moving on.
So his widow lamented that he has ended up stuck between the guardrails and the Christmas lights, like a stage character who fell in the wrong place and now finds himself directing the traffic of skaters.
See, what she's missing here is that this fucking rocks and is very funny to think
about. Yeah. Sorry, this is cool. You should have more interaction with statues.
Do we have a photo of this?
I live in a sort of like heavy interaction with a statue city, and it's genuinely delightful. So please. Yeah.
I am going to have to find a photo of this and put it in the show notes on Patreon. Mm-hmm.
Hold on. I'm going to send you a photo now in the group chat. The
WhatsApp group chat. God. He's got his arms spread wide open. I can see why he wants a high five.
That's really funny. No, I wasn't expecting to be like boards around him in that way. It looks like that one socialist illustration where the working classes are punching up through the floor, except the working classes are really happy to see
him. He's surrounded by wooden boards and like a glass cube.
Yeah, they've been cubed him. They put my man in a cube.
I had such a clear vision in my head of what this looked like, and it was completely wrong.
He's also, if you live in New York City, he's in the same position as the LaGuardia statue is downtown on LaGuardia Place, where he's like, hey.
Oh.
So, yeah. It would be so difficult not to high five this guy.
Oh, I wouldn't need a hashtag to tell me to high five him. I would be slapping skin to bronze every time I went past.
The worst part is, he's not even on that much of a pedestal when he's not on the ice rink, so he's lower than you. You're having to reach down to high five him.
Yeah, I guess you could say, at worst, it's kind of patronizing to Pavarotti.
Surrounding Pavarotti with a very ugly ice rink had ridiculed his memory, his Twitter said.
I can't believe that the widow of a famous opera singer would get in very high dudgeon about something kind of silly. Come on, that doesn't sound right.
If I lived in this town, beautiful. I'd be breaking into the ice rink at night to festoon him with things. He looks very festoonable. Like tinsel or lights.
A football scarf on him, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Maddie, you are so spiritually Glaswegian for that one.
For real.
Yeah, that is. Are you guys
festooning things often?
We're festooning. Well, we festoon a statue of the Duke of Edinburgh with a traffic cone on its head, but he's riding a horse. So sometimes we put a traffic cone on the horse's head as well.
Yeah. Well, that implies that the horse was killed by a car. in statue symbology.
Item the next. Now, sometimes the Mayor Tacula sings to us or through us about mayors who are in the news for reasons other than their mayoralty, or in this case, someone who was on a weak mayor city council, so wielded considerable local authority, and ran for leader of that council but lost.
An almost mayor in some ways.
This is an almost mayor, and one who I think we should discuss that they might serve as a warning to the others. I'm, of course, talking...
I know all mayors are listening.
Well, yeah, of course. I'm, of course, talking about Christy Fulnecki, the mother of the most wronged scholar in history, Samantha Fulnecki. Christy Fulnecki, and we will not be talking about that, by the way, because that's not a municipal matter.
No, you can go and listen to the beginning of the most recent Trash Future if you want to hear my jokes about that. Otherwise, you know, and I won't repeat them.
No, absolutely not.
And that's a bonus episode, so you have to pay me twice.
Yeah, you gotta pay up twice.
Well, this is a free episode.
Fuck.
Okay, once. So here's the thing. Christy Fulnecki was very clearly, I mean, I've seen her described as the epitome of American social rot. I think that's probably true. She's like a podcaster, an attorney, like a Jan 6 defense person. But she also was a city councilor from 2015 to 18 in Springfield, Missouri. And having read a lot of local news accounts of what she was like as a city councilor, I can conclude that this might be the most annoying person to ever live.
Fantastic. Oh. Let's hear it. Lay it on me.
So Christy Fulnecki is an attorney and business owner who lives in Springfield, absolute Christian maniac, family of six. And she's always been quite, let's say, politically active. But she was elected to Springfield City Council in 2015. And immediately she had three initiatives. None of them succeeded. In her first year in office, she pushed for the motto "In God We Trust" to be displayed in council chambers. She also spearheaded an initiative to unfree the nipple.
She imprisoned the nipple like Pavarotti at that ice rink.
So you put a gel ring around, put a gel ring, an ice rink around the nipple. A gel ring is what I call it when you've imprisoned Pavarotti.
I love to go skating on the gel rink. We're like slipping briefly and then just being entombed.
Yeah. Well, you don't understand. They're not keeping people away from Pavarotti with that cube. They're keeping him in.
The ooze rink. Uh-huh. Skate the ooze rink.
Group chat name has been changed. Okay.
I said the jail rink and you put the jail rink, but it's fine.
She wanted to unfree the nipple. And then she opposed a city pilot program that would give unhoused people free buses to the career center. The most liberal thing you could possibly imagine, saying instead what they should do.
No nudity, no careers fairs or whatever. In God we trust.
But and then she said her pushed an alternative bill that failed to criminalize panhandling.
Cool.
Oh, okay. They get you coming and going. Well, you're not going anywhere.
You're not going. Yep. They just get you. Mm-hmm. So in her first year in office, though, immediately everybody else in the council was like, "We fucking hate this person," and everyone who works there is like, "We also hate this person because they are awful." So what happened is,
I really appreciate your commitment to degendering this transphobic student's mom. Mm-hmm.
That's right. I'm they-theming Christy Fulnecki the whole time. So basically, the mayor of the city at the time received a letter signed by everyone else in the council saying that Fulnecki was not legally allowed to take the oath of office because she had illegally operated a business in Springfield without a license for 7 years.
All of your coworkers being like, "Yeah, we don't want to work with her, so here's a kind of pretextual reason why you can't hire her."
I have the story of how they got that information, which is even funnier. But Fulnecki Enterprises is not her law firm. It's a real estate development company because she's also a registered Native American. So it's a real estate development company that is
Oklahomans. Okay, sure. Yeah. Or Missourians in this case, I guess.
That's owned by a disadvantaged person.
Uh-huh.
That is specializes in, quote, helping companies do business with the government. Uh-huh. So basically it's hey, do you want to have someone who can claim Native American status on the board of your residential development? Hire me. Okay. But she didn't bother to get a business license. Basically what happened is no one knew about this. She actually alerted everyone to it by grandstanding about how she was a small businesswoman and how it's so hard to run a business with all the regulations. The city's business licensing supervisor, a woman named Buffy Smith, was in that meeting and took it upon herself to look in the city records to see if the business was properly licensed.
In the history of Buffy investigations, one of the lower stakes ones, but I appreciate it paying off.
Yeah, though this does appear to be a hellmouth of sorts, I will say.
But also, how much do you have to be hated if you say, "Well, I have a small business," and then immediately that's like, "Fuck, maybe she doesn't have a license. We're going to do a Hail Mary on her not having a license. We can get rid of her." It was during a routine plans and policies committee meeting in August that Councilwoman Fulnecki mentioned she's a small business owner, according to spokeswoman Cora Scott. So basically, they hate her so much, and they hate her. The reason they hate her is because she constantly goes on the local talk radio and says they're all liberals and she wants to fire all of them.
Hey, Riley. What's your source for this claim? I just think we should include the name of your source for this, for the basis of like completeness and transparency. So if you can just give me the name of your source for this.
Oh, that's just one of the many sources, and we will get to her.
Oh.
Are you talking? Do you want me to say the name of Bon Tyndall, November?
I would love for you to say the name of Bon Tyndall. Yes.
And also with you.
Okay.
when my French friend logs onto the apps.
Oh, Bon Tyndall.
Yeah. When I'm trying to compliment a fire being started in Esperanto. Bon Tyndall. So basically Bon Tyndall is Christy Fulnecki's lifelong mortal enemy. Like, she hates Christy Fulnecki.
I mean,
so
hell
much.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was gonna say, do you watch the season of that Ryan Murphy show, Feud Tyndall / Fulnecki?
Is Bon Tyndall then like just like a regular kind of in this house we believe kind of Democrat?
100%.
Fantastic. I love my cis allies so much.
If you ask Fulnecki, she says more like Mal Tyndall in a lot of ways.
Fucking got her ass, I'm afraid. I regret to say.
So she basically has a blog called the Bon Tyndall blog. She also had a podcast she did two episodes of.
Many such cases.
Called I think it's called The Bonfire Rises.
Ah, oh, it's a good title.
Okay. Yeah, pretty good.
I don't want to be too mean about Bon Tyndall.
Bon Tyndall.
Shut up, Bon Tyndall.
Bon Tyndall was just like trying stuff.
Yeah.
She was just trying stuff out, and she ultimately she's like published a lot like the books of poetry. Like, Bon Tyndall seems like she's a happy person, and I hope that Bon Tyndall gets everything she wants.
She's also on Threads. I hope she's never interacted with that Finnish mayor. Although, depending on if she speaks Finnish, if it's untranslatable, she's fine, you know?
Like, she basically, anything that Kirsti Fulnecki wanted to do, Bon Tyndall wrote a blog post about why it was a terrible idea, and also led a petition to have her recalled.
Okay. Critical support for Bon Tyndall.
In many ways, the kind of my equally horrible daughter has been sort of like got a failing grade from a trans professor, kind of the B plot in Fulnecki's life here, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's just what people happen to catch on to. So this is a story about why everyone hated her.
Everyone you know is fighting a battle you know nothing about with a woman who has a blog in their town. And it's just knockdown, drag out. Like, it's really malicious.
This is not from local news. This is from Bon Tyndall's blog.
Thank you for your journalism, Bon Tyndall.
And it's just called 10 Things to Know About Christy Fulnecki. So, though Mayor Bob Stevens was out of town, he felt obligated to correct an accusation made against city staff by Christy Fulnecki. The complaint was she had not received emails about breed-specific dog legislation that she should have been copied in on, and that's why she was unprepared.
She's an XL bully person?
No, and that's why she was unprepared for the council meeting. Mayor Stevens looked into this and discovered that Fulnecki had been copied into every single message. Fulnecki has not apologized for this false accusation that city staff were trying to undermine her.
This is exactly like the thing you and I had, Riley, the other day, where you called me and went, hey, you ready to do the episode of Trash Future today? And I went, I'm really pissed off at you for calling me into work on my day off because I had mixed up my days and I didn't know it was Thursday.
Yeah, basically, more or less. And she used to go on the radio and be like, yeah, I will. If I'm ever elected mayor, I will fire everyone who works for City Hall because they're all liberals. Anyone who doesn't like do whatever I say, I'll fire.
The liberal media made me forget to check my emails.
Oh, there's so many examples of that. But back to it. The thing about her having no business license, the city spent like $100,000 litigating the matter, including hiring an attorney to represent the council and paying a judge to oversee multiple administrative hearings. She then went on She then went on the radio to complain about the cost of the proceedings before again being informed that the only reason the proceedings were so expensive is that she just kept hiring lawyers to fight them. So she's like, I can't believe you didn't just let me win and this cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then she went like secretly recorded a meeting on her phone about that the council was having about her eligibility. That was a closed meeting that she wasn't invited to. She just walked in, sat down, made a phone recording, and they said, you can't release that. And then she released it to local news outlets without the city council's permission. Another judge on another administrative hearing said her actions were extremely disrespectful, but technically lawful.
Cool.
There's nothing in the rule book. It says a dog can't run for mayor. Yeah.
So yeah, she unsuccessfully campaigns for the mayor of Springfield during the most expensive race in Springfield history because she has so many wealthy donors in 2017, fought off a recall election spearheaded by Bond Tindall. But
Bond
the
Tindall
other
really the left's strongest warrior in a lot of ways. Like,
she's one of those, like, you know, like wine mom that when you actually ask what she believes, it's just what Mao said in a lot of ways.
I hope that Bond Tindall is a huge supporter of like Chairman Gonzalo thought.
So she also said that the city budget is not available for review and that liberal staff are keeping it from her and that she'd campaign on releasing the information so everyone could see it. Again, the mayor said the budget is and always has been online. You've just never been able to find it.
She just couldn't work the website?
Yeah, yep, correct. And then she decided that it was a conspiracy. She only resigned in 2018 because her family moved outside of city limits, saying, it's going to be nice to take a break from politics. But she definitely did stay involved in politics because after being like professionally a nuisance on the town council, she became professionally a nuisance legally. So she sued every single public body she could lay eyes on that did anything to prevent the spread of COVID to try to make them spread COVID.
God, these people are just how many people are there in America who are just waiting for a successful run at the right-wing outrage machine?
Yeah, she's like one of those fish that you can't put in a tank with another fish, I feel. Like, you just, wherever you put her, she's going to start biting the other people. I don't know.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. She, the only reason she doesn't, like, bite her family is if they're related to her and she can, like, sense it.
It's genuinely, like, waiting for something to get on, like, libs of TikTok or something.
Oh, yeah. 1,000%. So she sued a school that wanted to have a phased return. She sued two cities for having mask mandates. All these lawsuits were dismissed after much grandstanding from Fulnecki.
You just got to hit once, though, and then you're set for life is the thing. Literally. She's like, she knows that. Yeah. And
yeah, she's a venture capitalist.
Congratulations to her, I guess. On her recent fucking success.
So one of the lawsuits, before I sort of move off of this, was frankly quite odd. She filed a lawsuit against a telemedicine company stemming from an incident that a fellow middle-aged Ozark-based real estate lady named Sam Cherry tried to get a telemedicine consultation for her son's swimmer's ear, then was told that it was free with the promotional code COVID. This woman then went online and went on the warpath saying, this has associated my son with COVID, and it got huge traction on, like, stupid people internet. So CEO Steve Edwards said, in March,
they just like chose it because it was like a sort of COVID like telemedicine thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And she sued them on the basis.
So she went online and started this like big firestorm about something that fucking Cox Healthcare was doing COVID wise, the usual fucking nonsense. Uh-huh. So the lawsuit was actually about not wanting to be called a conspiracy theorist. Cause he was like, this is a conspiracy theory. The case made it to trial, her first one that made it to trial, and the judge basically just constantly called Fulnecki to the bench for like, you have to stop just ignoring the rules of court.
Cool.
And then they claim millions for harm to reputation, punitive damages, and emotional harm due to Cherry's previous PTSD diagnosis, with the jury finding in favor of Cox Health in 40 minutes.
That's Cherry a lunch break at that point, disguised as jury time. That's really good.
This is the last note. They then filed an appeal on the basis that the judge was a liberal who's biased against them, which was again denied the same afternoon.
It's a bad day.
You lose. Yeah. Your Honor, are you a liberal? No, you lose again. Yeah. Get out of my courtroom.
Yeah, so this was, of course, before she then spent the next several years representing J6ers, which she was more or less doing until the right-wing outrage machine finally...
Great representation. You are in Joe Biden's Abu Ghraib, being waterboarded with a liberal ideology every day, and your lawyer is this kind of lost Oklahoman who is mostly on her phone thinking about Bond Tindall's psychological warfare against her, who has been in court once over some absolute bullshit and lost.
I will say, with regards to the national media, why this woman is brought to our attention, I can only hope that Bond Tindall shows up and does something about this too.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Bond Tindall, if you're listening, you are our last hope.
Or maybe it's like a generational thing. Does Bond Tindall have a child who can like sort of be the sort of Wario to this woman's daughter.
So hold on, Bond Tindall has a child at like Liberty University and is going to get a 0 out of 25 for her 650 word essay on like evolution.
Yeah, it's like you get assigned like a biblical essay at Liberty University and you just talk about your pronouns for 650 words and then sue. And then under woke two, that goes all the way to the Supreme Court. That would be ideal.
They've got a cissexual professor.
Balance restored to the force, and also we terrorize all cisgender people and make them afraid to work in education.
Yep, that sounds pretty good. Wow. But that's my item.
What great items. Or as they say in Finland, vau, mitkä mahtavat tavarat. So.
Untranslatable.
Yeah, I've sexually harassed all of you by saying those words.
I'm thousands.
Afraid. Haldeman was actually speaking Finnish on the Nixon tapes. A lot of people didn't know that.
Unintelligible Finnish. Why do you think his name was Haldeman? I'm going to be thinking about Finnish Richard Nixon for a while now.
Sorry.
Even more depressed. Dan Smith. This is going to be a bit of a hauntological episode as well, because today we are in Newcastle, in the northeast of England. They don't pronounce it Newcastle there, they pronounce it Newcastle, but I feel like if I say it that way with my accent, it's a bit like the person who says like Afghanistan instead of Afghanistan in like a normal English conversation, where I'm like over-pronouncing it to show that I, you know, kind of like I'm au fait with the thing. So, Newcastle, in the northeast of England. This is in part where the Industrial Revolution started, and the whole of that region, Tyneside, was founded on coal. Newcastle is the chief port of Tyneside and the northeast, and so became sort of very industrialized and very wealthy. It's also where you get the expression coals to Newcastle, which is a British expression for uselessly taking something somewhere that famously already has a lot of it, like takes to a podcast studio or queer Yiddish anarchist pay what you want cafes to New York City.
Hey.
That is a specific micro beef that has taken out any Scottish listeners, and I'm just going to leave that there. anyway, as a major industrial port, Newcastle was obviously like horrendously bombed by the Germans during the Second World War. And so what we're going to talk about is firmly in the orbit of post-war reconstruction, the early 60s, because he was leader of the city council from 60 to 65.
Oh, I feel like this is going to be really annoying because it's going to remind us of the time when Britain did things like reconstruct after a crisis, as opposed to just being like, the crisis was fine.
It is. You love rubble. This is a sort of a morally complex one, actually.
Okay.
And I'm not quite sure how I feel about it. But so we'll do this as sort of straight biography to begin with. So our man T. Dan, he's born in a working class family in 1915 in Wallsend, which is a town a bit outside Newcastle. And it's a real kind of example of the kind of social relations that you could have in 1915, in that his dad is a coal miner, an autodidact who is fond of quoting Plato, an alcoholic, and a committed socialist.
Sounds about right.
Kind of guy you could be.
Oh, yeah.
His mum is a cleaning lady, also a socialist. You know, as a family, they go to socialist meetings and then church on Sundays. To kind of precisely articulate the class position here, they're what at the time would have been thought of as like respectable working class, right? Like it gets rough at points in the 20s. It's never luxurious, but a coal miner at this point is relatively well paid. And so he's growing up on like a terraced street of houses. It's not by any sort of standards of the time a slum. It's sort of like in the middle of middle to upper reaches of working class. Mm-hmm. All well and good. Goes to school. And then in this country, we had a very strange and very evil system where we had an exam.
What? That doesn't sound like us.
Yeah, I know, right? Called the 11 plus examination, where at the age of 11, you would take this exam that just determined the rest of your entire life. It was just like, if you pass this, you get to go to a state-funded grammar school, right? Like, which is intended for future fancy lads. Like, obviously, the top tier is just people who are going to be having their kids privately educated anyway and paying for it. And it doesn't matter how smart or dumb they are, right? But like, you could sort of your social mobility there was you passed this exam, again, at 11, and then you can sort of climb into maybe the kind of lower middle class, right?
Germany still does this.
Yeah, so does the Netherlands, so does Turkey, bunch of places. Sort of very, very common thing to do, to kind of stratify things in this way. And despite being, by all accounts, quite clever, he fails this exam, partially because it's difficult by design, and it's very much a kind of yachtsman is to regatta kind of exam. It's meant to be sort of selective on class as well. And he blames this on sort of anxiety on the day as well, which, Jesus, how could you not be, right?
I hate to take my my 11 plus exam for entry into the special boat, the special air service, and the first question is just, what color is the boathouse in Hereford?
Yeah, it's genuinely just like, I don't know, what color straw boater should you wear in sort of like April? And it's like, what? My dad is a coal miner. What are you talking about?
I already told you everything is covered in black dust.
Yeah, and so because of this, he goes
to be a trick question.
To the normal school for poor kids, which means he leaves school at 14 and becomes an apprentice painter, as in like house painter, like painter and decorator. Is still an avowed socialist at this point, for good reason, I would suggest. Like, you have the marks of capital all over your body.
Yeah, if I have to go paint houses because I don't know what color shoes to wear after July or whatever, like, I should, yeah, I'd also be pretty mad about the whole thing. Not like now, where I love it.
Of course. And so at 22, he founds his own painting and decorating company, although you kind of get the sense that it's more of a self-employment type beat. And then by this point, it's the 1930s, so he's unemployed for a lot of it and on benefits, you know, then on the dole.
Yeah. I assume because all the houses are already covered in soot, so there's no paint needed.
Yeah, you look at sort of like houses around Newcastle once in the 30s, and it's like layer of whitewash, layer of coal dust, layer of whitewash, layer of coal dust, until you just kind of create Fordite.
Mm. Yeah, hey, that's load. It's like puff pastry of paint and coal dust.
It's a Mealfoy. Yeah. Ironically, you have to paint the house because you can't define or spell Mealfoy. So World War II rolls around, and this is an interesting kind of examination of the state of the British left at this point. And by left, I mean left of the Labour Party, because he's a member of the ILP, the Independent Labour Party.
Ooh.
The one that was founded by Keir Hardie, the one that was sort of further to the left. And so along with this sort of socialist tendency, he is against the war, right? To the point of being a conscientious objector. I am not going to go to war. I'm not going to be drafted because I am a pacifist. In fact, he's a member of the Peace Pledge Union, who are the people who make the white poppies, you know, the woke ones. Mm-hmm. And this whole time he's a communist and socialist organizer. He organizes strikes during wartime, which happened a lot more than a lot of kind of British history of the early war represents. He's sort of like speaking to meetings. He's gaining local influence. And because in the Northeast, particularly, you have this base of communist and socialist support, he can do things like call a strike at a shipyard during wartime and not, you know, get like machine gunned or whatever. But the thing is, a lot of these sort of left organizations, you can frame this as a dual loyalty thing. It's not really. There are good reasons for this. Took their line from the Soviet Union, right? And the Soviet Union's line on the Second World War was, this is a kind of bourgeois sort of internecine struggle that the workers should have nothing to do. What the fuck do you mean, tanks on our border?
It's fine when we do it.
Yeah, when the Soviet Union gets invaded, he stops being a pacifist, right? Because he's a communist. And this is a sort of like, this is how you follow that party line. And there's many, many such cases. He also becomes a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
That is so funny. That is the funniest thing for him. I mean, it makes perfect sense at the time, but it's so funny from the perspective of now.
Yeah.
Like the Avakian RCP?
Similarly crankish, but different.
Okay, different
case.
One. Okay. So
the RCP that he joined was actually a revolutionary communist party.
Okay.
But, I mean, arguably all of these were sort of fronts to one degree or another for the, you know, like CPGB. But anyway, the Revolutionary Communist Party that is making Riley laugh was a 1980s founded libertarian cult that put out a magazine denying the genocide in Bosnia, and then got sued into oblivion, and then found, and then its intellectual successor founded a magazine called Spiked, where you can find Brendan O'Neill and his massive head talking about, you know, the fucking Islamo-Trans Alliance or whatever.
Yeah, I know about Spiked for some reason. I don't know why, but I do. Yeah. Unfortunately,
I'm sorry you know about it.
It might have been your fault. It might have been very funny to imagine
you're sort of like apprentice painter and communist reading Brendan O'Neill avidly. Mm-hmm. But so he is literally begged by the local Labour MP to join the Labour Party rather than stick with the ILP and the RCP and all of these other sort of like small left organizations. And this again follows a historical tendency, right? Where there are a lot of communists, and I mean serious, like avowed communists, who did entryism on the Labour Party. And this happened in waves, but he was in the sort of wave of the 40s. And so in 1945, he joins the Labour Party and runs for and then is elected to Newcastle City Council. And everyone knows he's a communist, right? But it's sort of like you moderate enough to sort of plausibly be a member of a still socialist party at this point, like the Labour Party, and you're like, but everyone knows. Mm.
Much like the RCP, it's funny considering the Labour Party now.
Yeah, absolutely.
As Tories too.
Also, Newcastle City Council is weird because for a long time, even though the Northeast has been quite red, the city council has been this kind of patrician Tory fiefdom. Mm. Owen Hatherley has a good article about Smith in which he describes them as incongruously Tory. Because it's just like your local elections, it goes to the same kind of city fathers as it always has, right? Mm-hmm. But in the 50s, you know, post-war, people are actually like voting more. They're sort of maybe more democratically engaged in these things. And so he has this fairly rapid rise to power. Like he joins the Labour Party in 45, and then he's chairman of the Labour group on the city council by 53. In 1958, Labour take control of the council in the 58 local elections, and the next year he is council leader. Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, he was never mayor. This is another city boss situation. I mean, he is elected as a councillor, but when you see the kind of heights of power that he ends up ascending to, it's very much like, this is not the job title, right? The job title is kind of just suggestive, and then the actual sort of power is sort of like extends from there.
Yeah, the city boss is an important column holding up the Meritaculus, in my opinion.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of the wheels around all of the eyes and wings. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, I cannot stress enough how much culturally T. Dan Smith comes from this communist background, which is becoming very adept at bureaucratic maneuvering. So, like, he has a lot of abilities.
That's the bit that I'm actually less about, like, what the British state is doing with its, you know, with people in charge of it who are entrepreneurial, but just the hard left being great at bureaucratic maneuvering and PR.
Yeah, remember that? Remember when the reason why the left had, like, 50 different political parties wasn't because all of them were falling out with each other? But at least mostly, but because they started founding front organizations and discarding them the second they were no longer useful. Like, it's genuinely, you can see the sort of like downstream effects of this. One of the reasons why your party is so weird is because the Socialist Workers Party is a party and isn't, and has a million little front organizations and can just get into an organization and really disrupt it. That's a combination of the legacy of this kind of organizing and also a lot of disruption of that kind of organizing, right? And so this is at a point where if you are a communist or a group of communists, so you can look at Newcastle City Council and think, this is about to be like a Labour sweep in local elections. There is power here that can be exploited successfully that no one else has realized is there. And T. Dan Smith, specifically, he is a guy who is good at PR, right? He is good at sort of advocating for things. And due to the sort of material conditions, he is able to do that while still being a sort of explicitly a like workers of the world unite type socialist. So he becomes leader of Newcastle City Council. And again, this is a real kind of like ermine, gown, big chain, fall asleep in meetings kind of job. And he comes in with two ideas. One is to create a kind of council cabinet, which you're not really supposed to do because that mimics how real power works, right? Like the prime minister has a cabinet. And it, if you as mayor of a city have a cabinet and you're like assigning cabinet secretaries to do things and you have departments, then that makes people very, very nervous in London because they think that you're trying to do things too. The second one is to create the first planning department in the UK.
Ooh, his own Robert Moses to carry out his will.
You're so right. Ooh. So this planning department and its town planner, a guy called Wilf Burns, they become the kind of chief instruments of his will, right?
I think it's cool they localized Robert Moses' name for England to call him Wilf Burns.
I think there are a ton of people.
Wilf Burns, of course, his granddaughter moved to Springfield, Missouri. It was called Pawn Tindall. Excuse me. Sorry. I'll show myself out.
Genuinely, this episode could be 5 or 6 hours long if all I had to do was talk about British post-war town planning as a discipline. But basically, as with the sort of communists, there's this political moment after the war where a bunch of British cities have been bombed flat, right? Like Coventry kind of no longer exists. London has like huge gaps in it. Cardiff, even Glasgow, even Clydebank, right?
I think about all the time is the Derek Jarman movie, Jubilee, is like a post-apocalyptic movie in London. And they filmed it in 1978 and it's in rubble. And that's just real rubble that was still around.
Yep, absolutely.
It's just mind-boggling to me.
Yes, yeah. The destruction was huge, but also there's an opportunity there, right? There is a real kind of political opportunity to do something differently in the governance of Britain, a place which is very resistant to changes in governance, along with an even rarer thing, which is the popular sense that something should be run differently. And one of the things that I really like about T. Dan Smith is he has this kind of preposterous ambition, right? There is absolutely no self-doubt in this guy. And okay, sure, he is running, he's kind of running a cult of personality, right? Like he's installing himself as Newcastle Stalin to the point that people are calling him Mr. Newcastle. But he has absolutely no hesitation.
Joey Cole.
Yeah. Mr. Big, they call him locally, right? Like, he has absolutely no hesitation about talking about Newcastle in the same breath as Rome or Athens. And as a comedian, I hate to give up what would otherwise be a really good laugh line, right? Because everything about the British class system inculcates you to find this series of words funny, right? He says that he has this vision that Newcastle could be the Brasilia of the North.
Oh, I mean, echoes of Eric Adams a little bit.
A little bit. But the thing is, you're meant to, as a British comedian, sort of reinforce the idea that this is laughable and be like, have you ever been to Newcastle? Right? Like, but I think it's really laudable because you can, like, Newcastle is one of those places that, like, London, because it's where all the stuff is and where all the people are, and because that perpetuates all the stuff and all the people being there, all of these regional cities, especially in the north, get completely devalued. And you end up with this sense, even among people from there often, that it's like, oh, well, of course it's shit and it's got to be shit forever. And to put it in contention with like a world city, somewhere that has history, that has stuff, somewhere like Athens, somewhere like, you know, like Rome, is funny, right? But there's no real reason why that should be so. And I think the Brasilia comparison is instructive in the sense that Brasilia is a planned city, right? Mm-hmm. It is an intentional capital that was built on fields, basically. And there isn't really a huge material reason why we couldn't do that in Britain other than London's where all the stuff is and that being a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Right.
I mean, they did it in, yeah, I guess, unless you're building like I think this happens in some countries in the 20th century when they're building like a capital from nowhere, like Brasilia or Canberra or something.
But so again, you see this focus on planning. Planning is a discipline, right? Where the city council is producing sort of like big glossy brochures of all of the sort of projects they're going to do. And we're going to totally rebuild this city because it is adapt or die, right? And a lot of this really astutely grasps some of the things that are going to happen to British cities in the 50s and 60s, right? And so there's this kind of real fervor, there's this kind of bureaucratic evangelism of planning and of development. And because, again, he is genuinely aiming for the top on this, he tries to lure Le Corbusier to Britain to be like, do you want to do a building in Newcastle? And Le Corbusier is like, no. there's like one Arne Jacobsen building, but besides that, he has to rely on sort of like local talent, local developers, local architects for a lot of this stuff, which we'll talk about. But because of that, because it's the 50s and because concrete seems very modern, a lot of the stuff that he wants to build is brutalist, right? And not brutalism with trees, brutalism without trees, non-eco-brutalism.
I don't like that.
It's the kind of thing where it's like, it looks very clean and modern futuristic on a drawing board.
And then for like the first 10 minutes of its existence.
Exactly. The architect never actually goes there. You have this idea that like, well, because we want to make it like Athens, it should have the climate of Athens, and therefore we can use sort of like just white concrete over everything. And because Newcastle is a wet climate that's cold, it gets sort of rained out instantly.
Yeah, the first rainstorm, it begins looking quite tired.
Yes, yeah.
I hope nobody here has any coal on their person.
It's the kind of brutalism that's aged really poorly and really kind of destroyed the sort of reputation historically of it as an artistic movie.
It's why everyone thinks brutalism is ugly. Yeah.
Yeah, because it wasn't built to the conditions, because it wasn't built well or maintained well. And it's a real shame because this, like our boy T. Dan Smith, really professed to care a lot about architecture. He had taken like night classes in it as a younger man. There's a passage in his autobiography where he says, "Why do you like water or mountains? Why is it that when buildings are put on the landscape, they appear to offend? Yet cows don't, sheep don't, dogs don't, trees don't, and flowers don't, no matter what their colors or what their shapes, whether it's calm, whether the wind's blowing, whether the trees are blowing about, whether it's autumn, spring, summer, or winter. Nature has a way of integrating its own objects into the landscape. Can we do this consciously as human beings? Of course we can. We can give just as much attention to a street lamp or a litter bin or a bus station or a bus shelter or a house or the color of a house or the color of a brick. These details are essentially in the mind of the artist, and this is why I need to try to direct the discussion towards the creation of a city in the image of Athens and Florence and Rome."
Remember when people in power used to give a half of a shit about the lived environment? Remember that? Yeah. Remember that?
Remember when they used to talk like this?
Oh my God, this is like gonna make me cry. Fuck, man.
I know. And then but then just to contrast this, I've got
please,
some images.
Make me feel better.
Just scroll down a bit and see. The four images that I've got of some sort of Newcastle city center planning.
Mm. I'd love to be like,
oh, this looks like Cumbernauld.
Yes, because it's from the same impulse and the same time, made out of the same materials, designed by the same people for the same reasons.
Like even in really specific ways, like being like, okay, obviously the car is the future. We can all agree on that, right? And then everyone says, well, yeah, of course the car is the future, but we need people to be able to walk. And then so you get these like ribbons of concrete of different size just sort of going everywhere where it's like, oh, the footpaths will have nothing to do with the cars, obviously, which again, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But like, we are going to emphasize cars everywhere because that's modern. That's individual. That's the next great big move forward for humanity is everyone has a car.
Yes. So we have like pedestrianized shopping areas overlooked by concrete blocks. We have this one image that I'm really, really fond of Newcastle City Centre with two layers of motorways, one elevated, and then above that, an elevated pedestrian walkway and a bunch of like tall multi-story car parks and apartment blocks all in concrete. It looks terrible.
Here's a question for you. Did you know that there was an abortive attempt to make London like this?
Yes, the ringways.
Yeah, it's the ringways thing. And like you can see a couple of the council, like buildings of council estates. Like there's one in, like the Barbican was obviously like going to be the centerpiece of it. But then there are like little council estates in like Covent Garden, for example, that were built to like in anticipation of this getting made.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is like it, there are little hints of this everywhere.
It's pure historical accident where it happens and where it doesn't. Like sort of the difference between Glasgow and London, right? I'll talk about the reason why, right? So basically what we're doing here is what Hatherley calls Tyneside modernism. And that's one sort of regional example of a phenomenon that's really interesting because it correctly and really astutely observes a lot of the kind of problems and challenges of the future and really kind of calls for a bold exercise of municipal power to choose the wrong solution every time. So besides being a city councillor, T. Dan Smith had also been on the Buchanan Committee, which had been a committee on traffic management and more broadly what cars were doing to cities. And this is a fascinating piece of reporting because it grasps that cars are going to just strangle every city in Britain to the point that it actually overestimates the amount of future car use. It fully takes the assumption that people are going to treat cars like overcoats in the sense of like everyone is going to have one and think as little of it as that. But it kind of understands that your historic city center cannot survive that many cars. And so you either need to just ban cars from them or you need to adapt to that in some way. And it doesn't really suggest any one of those, but one of the options that it gives is just create a lot of urban motorways or ring roads mm-hmm. or elevated roads, things like that.
Pleasant things that people love. To this
exactly day. Right. It's yeah. It's something that doesn't really grasp the concept of induced demand. Just one more lane, bro.
Well, because you know what it is. It's a concept. Actually, you and I have discussed before. It is high modernism, but kind of starting from a sort of random place.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's very much sort of car-centric modernism. And yeah. and the interesting thing about this is that no one involved is particularly happy about the car necessarily. They just kind of take it as a fact. It's like a diagnosis, you know, like your cars are going to metastasize. But so this is how Newcastle and, for instance, Glasgow get these huge motorways run through them that, you know, destroy huge amounts of housing, entire communities, and also create this weird mm-hmm. effect where they're like rivers in a lot of ways. Like, so for instance, if you want to go from the west end of Glasgow to the city center, you have to cross over a large motorway, the M8, potentially either over sort of like streets built over it or over like a big raised concrete pedestrian footbridge. Yeah. And it's really isolating. And they intended that to be a ring road. It was going to go around the other three sides of the city, but it was so unpopular that they stopped at one.
Geordie Robert Moses, you will pay for your crimes. Like this is like almost exactly what Moses did to specifically the Bronx. Where my family was, you know, they put a humongous freeway right in the middle of it. I mean, this is in my neighborhood now in Queens, where there's just like a sunken highway in the middle of the neighborhood, and crossing over it becomes this thing where, like, yeah, you got to fucking ford it. Like, it's a decision you have to make to get across this thing instead of just wandering around the neighborhood like you used to be able to do.
This planner, Wilf Burns, goes to he's like modeling this off of Fort Worth, by the way.
That is so grim. Oh my God.
T. Dan Smith says, we're going to make Newcastle the Athens Newcastle will be spoken of in the same breath as Athens or Rome.
Or Fort Worth.
And his town planner is like, gotcha, Fort Worth.
Well, because Fort Worth felt like the future.
Not even Dallas.
Yeah. Or Fort Worth. Yeah. Yeah. Athens, Rome, and Fort Worth.
So similarly, because of this understanding that like a lot of cars are coming into city centers, there's this understanding that like shopping is going to change, right? The economy of a city center is going to change. And you can't have lots of streets full of shops anymore. And so the future is either big shopping mall outside of town or big shopping mall in town. And so that's what they go with. And one of the things that they push through in Newcastle is the central pedestrianized shopping center bit that's still there. It's called Eldon Square because of this kind of recognition that you can't have shopping parades anymore. And what a better sort of adaptive solution to do that is you have a lot of multi-story car parks because public transport isn't going to be enough and people don't want it. They want to drive. So you build a bunch of multi-story car parks. People drive their car into those, and then they go and shop, and then they drive home.
Just a complete misunderstanding of like what the scale of life should look like.
Yeah, but it's the thing. It's different.
Every major city on Earth was like this around the in the early 60s. They almost put a highway through the French Quarter in New Orleans. Yeah. Like,
and it's just sort of really, really accepting. Like, okay, we've looked at this, and this is the future. This is what it has to look like, and we're going to sort of adapt to that. And so, this idea of like building your way up to that, and in particular, all of this is made of concrete, and there's a lot of verticality to it as well. There's a lot of these like overhead walkways.
Tyneside Blade Runner.
Yeah, I mean, so genuinely, like these overhead walkways, a lot of them are still there, but they don't connect to anything anymore.
Oh, good.
And they're sort of like, they look terrifying. There's some incredible photography of them. Because it was genuinely meant that you would sort of transition from your car to walking and just go up or down. It's in a lot of ways, it's sort of less like Athens and more like Hong Kong. But at the same time, this kind of recognition that like, oh, the economy is going to be fucked by modernity leads to some genuinely quite prescient things. So for instance, one of these other big projects is what would now probably be called a tech campus. Mm-hmm. In the city center, Newcastle has two universities in the middle of town. And the reason why is because one of them was a polytechnic originally. And it was just kind of thought that this would be the thing, is people would become knowledge workers, right? Like Smith says, of sort of like of a coal pit, all of the miners' sons will grow up to be scientists and computer men.
Does he mean robots?
Possibly. I'm not going to do a Northeastern accent for this, but I do derive some pleasure from hearing computer men in one.
It's really good.
I mean, again, he's right. Weird. Yeah, he's sort of right.
Yeah, he's been sort of like thrown the dodgeball of prophecy, right? And I have a quote here from an article about him by Alex Niven in Tribune. At the AGM of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1970, Newcastle politician T. Dan Smith delivered a powerful speech about a utopian, technology-filled future he claimed was just around the corner. This gangly, hectoring man, dressed in an expensive suit, predicted briefcase computers by 1975, synthetic protein foods by 1980, a huge expansion of electronic film and music production, full automation of major industries, and the installation of personal computers in every home by the year 2000.
In the year 2000.
That is remarkable that he's really kind of only off by a couple, like by the time.
Yeah, he's like batting like 900 on this.
Yeah.
Like briefcase computers sound fucking great, but like the man predicted math core. Like, I don't, how the fuck do you do... And it's this really strange thing where you look at someone looking into the future from the past and getting it slightly wrong and often right, and culminating in this weirdness, this hauntology of really truly believing that human civilization is going to culminate in the singularity that happens in Newcastle Town Center in 2000.
It's all computer now, he said.
You know what? I'm gonna go out on a limb here. Maybe I'm completely off base, but his view of technology reminds me of someone else's, which is Tony Blair.
Oh, we'll get there. Do not worry. This is different generations of Labour Party futurism and sometimes going to the same place, right? Like, so if the first generation is T. Dan Smith putting the Polytechnic in the center of town, the second one is making that Polytechnic a university, right? Mm. And so that's sort of where I'm building to with this.
And like, it's so weird seeing Keir Starmer trying to do it also, but utterly failing to believe it in the way that T. Dan Smith or Tony Blair, because Tony Blair did really believe it.
Yeah.
Right? It's so weird seeing him say this about like the fakest technology in history.
For real. So, I mean, this is the thing, right? We kind of know this story, right? We know where this ended up in a lot of places. Like, even if you don't know sort of Newcastle history, you have a sense of why people don't like brutalism, right? And so a lot of this stuff that got built, like even within a decade, seemed alien and inhumane and cruel. If you've seen the film Get Carter, which we will be doing on Kill James Bond, as a sort of piece of British neo-noir, there's a really like terrifyingly austere multi-story car park in that. That's a T. Dan Smith original.
Mm.
Likewise, a lot of those like elevated walkways that are terrifying now. But the big challenge wasn't any of these like big projects, right? A lot of which like he wasn't involved with. Most notably the Tyne and Wear Metro, which is, you know, like sort of one of the only, bar in Glasgow, like subway systems outside of London and like the only like new one. He can't take any credit for that. That wasn't him. His big thing was housing. He was a housing guy because that was the huge challenge, because you did have like a sort of a post-war baby boom, but you also had this complete sort of social reorganization post-war, and a lot of housing stock had been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where we get to the really kind of controversial bit, because as I say, we know this story. We know what it's like when a sort of visionary who really likes concrete and verticality decides he's just going to move everybody into tower blocks, right?
Like, yeah, Ehud Olmert.
Yeah, exactly. No,
people like to be suddenly moved, again. Right?
Yeah, people like to be moved. People like to be cleared, I think.
Mm-hmm. They like to be displaced, but in a way that's in a fun way. Like upwards. Yeah. You know, upwards towards heaven.
You know how everybody in Taxi Driver said, I can't wait till a real rain is going to fall and wash us all away.
So there's a lot of streets in the sky kind of modernism going on here. A lot of tower blocks getting built. A lot of tower blocks getting built out of town, right? Because mm-hmm. the idea is that you'll have these beautiful transport links so that you'll be able to go from your tower block to your pedestrianized city center. You won't need to live in the middle of town anymore.
Oh, great. You like your house? Too bad. You live in Geordie Coruscant now. Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to City 17. And a lot of these new blocks are not built well. They're not maintained well. They're not popular with the residents because they weren't built with any input from the residents. This was very much the council tells you where your house is going to be because it's a council house. You live in social housing. Like back when we had that, and back when we had that for a lot more people than we do now. So they fully could just move people. And much of this is done, as everywhere, in the name of slum clearance, right? Now, a lot of places that get cleared this way aren't slums. They're just poor and old buildings, right? In a lot of cases, it's kind of vibe profiling, because if you want to make Brasilia, then your sort of Georgian town center, which Newcastle had, doesn't really fit with that. It's not intentional. It doesn't fit with your kind of shopping precinct.
Yeah, because as you say, Brasilia was built on fields, whereas this is being built on Newcastle, not fields.
Yes, exactly. Newcastle had this Georgian town centre, much of which is just gone now because it either had a motorway put through it or because a Georgian terraced house doesn't feel modern in 1965 and it just gets demolished instead of being renovated. Now, some of that is funding from central government, which doesn't want to renovate anything because they also have kind of building mania. The funding of all of this stuff also kind of opaque, right? Like the thing is, you'll get a very PR, very glossy brochure from the council telling you you are being moved to a nice new tower block. And then it will say, you know, the funding for this scheme is being borrowed and include no further details, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry. This is not going to have any effects downstream.
Oh, great. I was about to ask.
Meanwhile, now, you know, everyone in Britain would stab their own parents to death for a chance to live in a flat in a renovated Georgian terraced house because they're good buildings and we don't make those anymore.
I will say stabbing your parents to death seems to be the best way to get one.
Quite possibly, yeah. And as well as
I do not endorse stabbing your parents to death to steal their house, just FYI. The British government, if you're listening.
This kind of phantasmic slum clearance, it also creates slums because, again, a lot of these tower blocks are not funded well at all, and we know how those can kind of be criminogenic, right? Like in particular, there's this one housing development at Noble Street where they put up some tower blocks and it gets so bad that in 20 years in the 70s they have to demolish it again. It's just like this modernism is it has failed. It's a failed experiment.
Yeah, it's the same thing in like you see this sort of everywhere where there is this idea that if we just improve the dwellings mm-hmm. and we have some theory about the dwellings, yeah. you know, then, we're going to be able to, let's say lift people up without sort of wider, thoroughgoing program of social reform, or that these things will carry their own political and economic logic. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, in Naples, outside of Naples, the town of Scampia, there is another sort of utopian housing project called Levele, the sales, that were just where the Camorra then based themselves, because yeah. it wasn't, you have this one idea and it's not accompanied by all the rest.
Yeah, this stuff wasn't supposed to happen in this way. Mm-hmm. And again, bearing in mind that all of these people were communists, you know, this is meant to be historically progressive, you know, all of this is premised on the idea that the council should be acting and should be spending money and exercising power and not worrying a lot about its purse strings necessarily, because it's going to uplift things. And that's not necessarily a bad idea. So, and I mean, some of this stuff is good, genuinely. Like, they get a few good buildings out of it. In particular,
it's good that they're doing it. It's good that they're trying stuff. It's better than fucking what we currently have.
Yeah. So, the Biker Wall is a nice, successful, brutalist housing scheme. It's been recently renovated, which, you know, jerk off motion, but fine. Because it was built in consultation with the local community, and because the place it was built on top of actually was a slum. Mm. Like, these things can work. It's just, again, the guy wants to build Brasilia, right? And so when there's an opportunity to put a building down that looks like Brasilia, he takes it. And when that is a solution that works, it works very well. But a lot of the time it doesn't. There's a quote from him, again from his autobiography, that's really, really striking about the kind of sense of the time. He says, "We've got to talk in terms of new cities. Just as in the Industrial Revolution, we were ahead of our time, in the Age of Leisure, we ourselves will also be leading the way."
Age of Leisure?
The Age of Leisure, yeah. Like, it was going to be fully automated luxury communism. You were going to be able to work on the briefcase computer and in from your council house.
Yeah. I can hear the background music from the Venture Brothers playing almost exactly.
I'm thinking of the throwback episode of the Channel 4 series Utopia set in 1974, where they changed the aspect ratio back to square. The other thing about T. Dan Smith is that he is shamelessly partisan for the Northeast, right? We talked before about the kind of internalized anxieties of that, of like having to sort of shave off your accent, which notably he never did, and of sort of like talking down where you're from in this country if it's not kind of sufficiently socially prestigious. And this isn't a guy that does that. This is a guy who the most dangerous place on earth to be is between him and a camera, because he will shove anyone out of the way to talk about how good Newcastle is. Mm-hmm. He has this nickname, the Mouth of the Tyne, right? And the other thing is, because he's trying to do this as like, and I'm Newcastle Stalin, or, you know, sort of the king of Newcastle, all of this is self-interested as well, right? Like, and it takes all of the opportunities provided by these kind of modernist currents. He's on something called the Redcliffe Maud Commission for local government, because basically, like, we had no devolved local government in England sort of immediately post-war. And this was getting weirder and weirder, because we had cities that weren't London just being governed from London. And there was this kind of awareness that you needed more than like a parish council for this. And there was this awareness also that, like, equally having 5 billion parish councils that contain one church, one man and one dog is not very efficient when you can have regions. And that would be a good way to centrally plan an economy. So something has to change, and people are sort of minded to change it. One of the things he pushes through when he's on this commission is England should be entirely federalized. Mm-hmm. It should be administered at like a provincial level. And one of those provinces should be configured in such a way that Newcastle is the capital of 17 million people.
I do love the sort of like he's trying to gerrymander like Tyneside,
yeah,
to be like have a big like finger of it what that goes into like Yorkshire.
Yeah, this guy absolutely would have created a sort of Holy Roman Empire princely state if you'd let him. They didn't let him. I sort of think it's a shame because like I think there are good arguments for regionalism done a certain way. I, you know, the Northern Independence Party is sleeping. Who shall rouse him up? But instead, the Conservatives get elected and they kick the report into the long grass and things fall into this kind of stasis instead, which is pretty bad.
Like so many things, like devolution, any kind of regionalism or devolution in England gets kind of half done in one of the parliaments where they do stuff. And then yes. just kind of gets left half done more or less forever and then fudged by Blair.
What you tend to get are a lot of sort of like white collar jobs programs, like regional development corporations, which, you know, have power when it's inconvenient for them to have them. But so, you know, we don't get the Newcastle Republic, which is, I think, a real shame. But how are we feeling about T. Dan Smith at this point? We mentioned the optimism, maybe? Yeah. Like, we're going to
ambitious,
we're
gonna but medium successful.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know what I'm going to say? I like T. Dan Smith, and that's the end of the episode. Nova, thank you so much. This is what an interesting character.
I hope nothing weird happens.
Uh-huh. I have a few questions.
Oh, no.
T. Dan Smith.
Okay. Oh, no.
Let's hear them.
How come half the contracts Newcastle City Council are awarding are being awarded to your painting and decorating company?
The one that's just him?
The one that now has 250 employees.
Oh, oh, is that more? No.
How come, no. T. Dan Smith, you have a Jaguar with a custom number plate that says Dan 68?
Oh,
and
no.
why did you take a photo of it in front of a school you're demolishing?
Oh, no.
And I've included that photo.
I hope he doesn't have 68 Jaguars.
Further question, how come you're sending your children to private school as a socialist, as a communist?
Entryism. He's doing entryism.
So yeah, why are you living in an area of Newcastle that is becoming known as Millionaire's Row?
Because a million people live there?
Why are you buying a flat in London in St. James's Park?
Well, okay, that's a beachhead.
And
wait, what is St. James's Park fancy? Is that fancy?
It's preposterous.
It sounds fancy, yes. But everything in England sounds fancy to me. A rube.
It's where Buckingham Palace is. Buckingham Palace
is. That's one of the fanciest houses they have.
It's sort of like you want to come in at the top of the market. Yeah. So I sort of think arguably a decent follow-up question to this would be, how are you buying a flat in London in St. James's Park?
As is mayor the mayor well paid? Is the mayor a well-paid position?
No, not at all.
Is there a buried treasure in Newcastle?
It's possible.
Perhaps that, like, of legend that he found?
At the time, people agree to maybe believe that there is.
Oh.
And so for the moment, we just park that, much like the Jaguar with the custom number plate.
In front of the school.
Yes, yeah. So never mind all that.
Okay.
1964 election, the Labour Party wins. Harold Wilson is elected Prime Minister. A lot of people start frowning quite intensely in MI5. And T. Dan Smith is sitting by the phone waiting for the call. He is fully expecting that Harold Wilson is going to be like, do you want a job as a cabinet minister? He really thinks that he's in contention for this as like a national political figure and that he's owed it as a sort of man of the left, as a loyal member of the Labour Party since 1945.
Here's a quick question.
Uh-huh.
He's not an MP. So
no, he isn't.
How would he join cabinet?
Do you have to be a member of parliament to be in the cabinet?
You could be a lord, I guess. Okay. I guess Harold Wilson could make him a lord.
I think that's genuinely what he was expecting him to do, yes.
okay.
And then the funniest possible thing happens. Harold Wilson is too far left for him. Quite genuinely, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom looks at a guy who calls people comrade, sings the red flag every year at conference, and it has, like, as a former member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and goes, I don't trust that guy to be left-wing enough.
Oh, man.
My goodness.
What a world we lost.
Oh my Lord.
In the 60s.
God, we could have had, there was such a big fulcrum about 5 years after this, huh? We really could have had some
bag.
We really could have had something
that we fumbled. I mean, okay, there is still kind of London dominance going on here, and there is still a bit of like Labour sort of internecine stuff, and that Wilson has his own kind of network.
And also,
right?
He's got that House of Millionaires Row, maybe.
Yeah,
he's genuinely the
Wilson camp are genuinely quite suspicious of him,
sure.
Right? And there are a few good reasons to be, those questions we mentioned above.
He's no Bond Tindall.
That's right. and he's never been an MP. He's just kind of like a local boss. And despite, you know, being socialists, the Wilson sort of ministry are still willing to indulge in a bit of like, well, he's kind of just like our man in the north, right? Mm. And ultimately, he quits his job at the council to go and work doing basically the same job of like economic overlord of the north of England at a regional development council, which was one of those things that had been created to avoid doing his sort of beloved regionalism, right? Mm-hmm. So that they hand him like a do-nothing job instead of like cabinet post, which is what he wanted. Snubbed.
Mm,
yep. Well, so, maybe he was the missing piece.
So about those questions.
I was going to say, so he lived the rest of his life in obscurity. What happened here? Mm-hmm. End of the episode?
You remember how I mentioned that he couldn't get Le Corbusier, right? Mm. And you know, there wasn't a lot of sort of international interest in Newcastle. Mm-hmm. And so mostly all of these contracts, and Newcastle City Council builds a lot, but those contracts tend to go through this one developer called John Paulson.
Is it like a local Corbusier?
Yeah, local Corbusier.
That's what the LUD stands for. It stands for local. Local.
To be clear, John Paulson is not an artist, local, right? Corbusier. He's very much like, you have a good relationship with him, and if you need a building, he will get you a building. A building will be there. Mm. Maybe don't ask too many questions about what it's made out of or what the sort of quality of it is.
You got it.
If you want a sort of London comparison, he did Cannon Street Station. So a building which is completely unremarkable, like 70s brutalism.
I'm looking at it.
Kind of shit, kind of depressing.
It just
kind of
looks like...
good enough for government work kind of building, because he got a lot out of British Rail and other nationalized industries. And T. Dan Smith was his friend in the north, right? And a lot of northeastern power broking went through the two of them. And, okay, so the north of England is a spiritually evil place, right? Mm-hmm. I think I'm allowed to say that after being like, Newcastle's allowed to be Athens if it wants, right? But like,
yeah,
because it has local power and is different from and distinct from London, it has its own evils, right? And you get a lot of kind of big fish, small pond things, right? Which is why it's interesting to talk about a mayor of it. And this is some real Red Riding series shit, in that you can pull any of these threads just as far as you want. I used to have a friend who insisted point blank that the portal of all satanic evil into the waking world was in Leeds. Mm-hmm. On the basis of... this was actually before the Savile stuff came out. So... Yeah. It was purely just on the basis of West Yorkshire police is pretty evil. Yorkshire property developers are pretty evil. It seems like there's this weird incestuous relationship between the police and the politicians and the developers and Freemasons. And
I mean, Manchester's the same way, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, like Yorkshire, Manchester, Tyneside... All of this kind of gives me a bit of a shiver, right? And
yeah, like the way that those sit, like, yeah. In my understanding as a dipshit who lives far away, my understanding of those places is very much like they were run severely by like captains of industry for 100 years, and it made them a little evil. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it was. Okay. It's definitely getting out of the top hat era, and mm-hmm. and suddenly like, yeah, getting really strange and dark, and I don't know. You can get real, like, sort of iceberg meme about this and sort of wonder how much stuff is still... Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. How much of this stuff is still, like, buried. And so Paulson's business model, right, is he bribes you. That's kind of the whole business model. he shows up... Yeah, it's a good business model. He shows up, he gives you a lot of money. Ideally, when you're like a, you know, a mayor of a sort of a town, or you're someone in sort of like middle or junior authority, you're a junior civil servant or whatever. And then a few years later, when you're sort of a bit more influential and a bit more powerful, your godfather wants a favor. And the favor is, contract me to do this building and I'll do kind of a shit job.
Okay.
Right?
I will say something after doing this show for a while now. I'm rounding on a theory that bribes mm-hmm. work. I think bribes work. It works when you bribe somebody for a while.
The only thing is,
for a while,
you know,
it works.
You know how you get this thing? Well, you know how I sometimes get this thing where I'm like, if I don't check my bank account, it isn't real, so I can mm-hmm. spend this money? Don't do that if you're bribing people. because
I
shit you not, this guy Paulson goes bankrupt from bribing too many people too much money.
Oh my God. So it's like,
I've got a hole in my bribing pocket.
Bribes work, but you do, you have to nail it.
You have to keep one eye on the expenditures.
Yeah, you got
to
keep one eye on your own socks while stuffing other people's socks full of money.
This must be the only, you very rarely hear of someone going out of business from, like, not from paying bribes you have to pay,
but
like entrepreneurially paying bribes. This very rarely happens.
Yeah, he's a very bad entrepreneur. Also, he's like spreading himself very thin. Like, this is, he's bribing officials in Scotland. He's bribing like British Rail. He's bribing all the nationalized industries and all over the north, right? Particularly. And T. Dan Smith is his guy for bringing in new people in the north, right? So, like, if you were mayor of a sort of like a town, it's not this guy Paulson who brings you the offer. It's T. Dan Smith. He's the bag man.
How many times are they going to fucking invent the mob on this show? I swear to God, I'm sick of it.
I know.
Sick of it.
I know.
The mob again, pulling the big lever.
He's the guy who shows up with the suitcase full of money. He's the one who starts stuffing money under your flat cap. And so
he's Jordy Salvo Lima.
Yeah. And he's sort of like, nominally, he's hired as a consultant for Paulson's like PR firm, where he's getting like a sort of a 1% commission on schemes that he himself has sort of like been the bribery bagman to facilitate. And ultimately this arrives at his door, because when Paulson goes bankrupt, it turns out that bankruptcy courts like to ask you some questions about what you've been spending the money on, and they don't like the answer bribes.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Did he not have another answer ready?
Did he? Oh, you know what? He couldn't bribe the judge because he was out of bribing money.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Ah!
He claimed that he was being exploited by a bunch of greedy mayors who would come to him for bribes.
So much for mayor solidarity.
I mean, I guess arguably since he ran out of money, maybe he was onto something. Like, he has this insanely hard line at trial. Again, people used to talk like this. He says, "I have been a fool surrounded by a pack of leeches. I took on the world on its own terms, and no one can deny I once had it in my fist."
Wow. That rocks.
Is the guy who talks like this a good property developer? So T. Dan Smith, incredibly corrupt, right? And this comes out. It becomes apparent that he's taken 156 grand that they know about, right? Mm-hmm. Potentially way more that they don't.
And just in context as well, like in the middle of the 20th century, like that's a lot of money now. That's so much more in the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah. And again, God only knows what else he was up to. And you can get some real like conspiracy thread out of this. Also, it's worth noting that him being the kind of like recruiter for corruption, that's also old left skills. You know, like that's sort of cultivating assets in the way that you still sort of like get Trotskyists doing. Ultimately, what he's doing is selling newspapers on a way bigger scale.
He's selling how to spend it from the Financial Times.
Yeah. Sorry, that's like $3.5 million. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. So to be clear, he's like the bagman, right? There are a lot of other more senior people who are implicated by this, including multiple MPs. Most notably, a former Conservative Home Secretary called Reginald Maudling, who at one point was in serious contention to be Prime Minister. All of the MPs get off on a technicality.
Shocking.
And the technicality is the most fucking thumb on the scale thing ever, which is that legally at this point, an MP wasn't in charge of public funds in the way that a councillor was.
So,
got off scot-free.
You're not... So, because an MP doesn't directly make spending decisions, basically.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, wow.
If you're a civil servant, you were fucked. If you were a counselor, you were fucked. But because you couldn't, strictly speaking, tell anyone to do anything, an MP was fine. Mm-hmm. This is different now. They have closed that loophole, but it was just one of the most naked kind of like Westminster system antibodies here. And so the MPs get away clean. T-Dan Smith gets 6 years in prison. And they really come down on this guy.
Tall prison.
Yeah, like...
It's not like a sort of... Or it's not a high modernist prison, I imagine.
No, no. And like, they're fully, like, you have brought, like, disgrace to Tyneside. They really, like, hammer this guy. And, I mean, this is one of those things where you can go, this is sort of, like... There's an ulterior motive here, right? In the sense that he absolutely had his hand in the till the whole time, right? It's the Everard Clare thing, right? He was a corrupt motherfucker. However... Getting rid of him also happens to call a halt to this style of urban modernism and town planning and left entryism and Labour Party members calling each other comrade. And it's one of the things that ultimately in the sort of run of history ushers in the plastic clad student flats style of urban modernism and right entryism and Labour Party members calling each other Tony and Gordon and doing much less prosecutable forms of corruption.
Yeah, like, it's like you realize the best form of corruption to do is you wait until you're done being a politician, then you start an institute.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so at the time and subsequently, his defense is always ideological, right? Like, I was trying to do Brasilia, and I was using this guy instrumentally with the bribes to let me do that, rather than the reverse of, I wanted the bribes, and so I concocted a bunch of shit about Brasilia.
And so I got a Jaguar and two nice houses.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Just sort of a byproduct of me wanting to do Brasilia.
Yeah,
I guess.
He has the most Clay Davis quotes. Again, this is from his autobiography. I am by nature a wheeler dealer.
Your Honor, I am by nature a wheeler dealer.
How else can you be a successful politician and get your ideas across? Now I was being asked to deal with for someone else, and at the time I could see nothing wrong with it. For all the work I have done for the community, for all the early promise of distinction and power, I am left with nothing. People like me are expected to work full-time without salaries, without staff, or even postage stamps. I, for one, couldn't afford such a situation, and that is where Paulson filled the gap. I came to the conclusion that I was missing out, that I could combine my real desire to give public service with what they called a piece of the action.
Is he our most eloquent guy we've ever covered?
It's very possible.
I actually like his writing quite a bit.
People talk about how effective a communicator he was. Years later, sort of like in the wilderness, they had him on a sort of like famously drunken and sort of provocative late night ITV show. And people were like, holy shit, this guy who went to prison is like really convincing. Mm. This disgraced politician is like, and he was, again, still firmly on that sort of left thing of the institutions of capital are irremediably corrupt. And corruption is legalized when it's in service of capital. Like, these are that's like almost verbatim.
He's right, but he shouldn't say it at the window of a mansion that he bought with private money.
Yeah, exactly. But like, even then, the people who responded to that well, there are people you can find writing about it who are like, you should have seen him in the old days. Like, this is him sort of like low energy. And you think about the kind of promise of like a socialist politician who could communicate in that way. Not just to say those things, but to say those things in a way that, you know, really kind of grabbed people and really made them feel like they were a part of a modernist, futurist project that was going to end with the age of leisure and the briefcase computer, right? It's shocking. And so he goes to prison. That ends his political career. And generally today, he is remembered almost exclusively for the corruption. There's been a bit of a kind of reassessment. There's been a bit of a backswing of, you know, well, maybe he was trying to get things done after all, or, you know, hero or villain, the socialism of T. Dan Smith.
Ruba Mazfas. He steals, but he works.
That's right.
Well, yeah, quite. And I mean, this is a guy who at the time, at the height of his power, Beatrix Campbell called him Faust in a trench coat. Right, like he was posing a sort of serious moral challenge, and there's a real kind of quantum superposition of like, why is he corrupt? Does it matter that he's corrupt? Does the things that he's doing, to what extent are they impaired by the corruption? I don't know the answer to that, but ultimately he got out of prison, and he ended up living in the 14th floor of one of his own tower blocks as a kind of benignly ignored campaigner for prison reform and for pensioners' rights. He starred in a sort of quasi-fictional meta film about his own life called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Utopia.
It's a good title.
And died in 1993. And genuinely, he is a key reason why it's taken this long for Britain to get powerful mayors again. Like, we're in a situation now where we have sort of the likes of an Andy Burnham in Manchester, right? But like, that never could have been the case because that kind of local government reform was all kicked into, I don't know, some kind of regional council development thing because it was this terrifying prospect of a local power base, partially because of the corruption and partially just because it's like, why allow that kind of rival? Why allow that kind of power? And so in many ways, he and a guy called Andrew Cunningham, who was like another big Northeast guy who also went down in the same corruption case, they were the sort of like first and last big mayors of post-war Britain of the 20th century. And we just did not get their like again until Ken Livingstone in London. And that's a really special case.
Wow.
Wow.
Damn.
God, what a figure.
I really love your sort of series, along with Highgill, the series of like the lost communist future of the West.
It's happened so many times.
Highgill,
so many fumbles.
The guy in Denver, what was his name?
Yeah, it's just like corruption or incompetence or distraction or just one guy who's not feeling it or just dumb luck, but we keep coming right up against it. And I just, the planet's dying, Cloud. Like, it's, we don't have a lot of time to get this right.
Yeah.
I'm really gonna need a mayor who actually does the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really putting it all on Zoran.
Yeah.
Hey, Zoran,
will not backfire.
Zoran?
This is a message to Zoran from us.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get rich from being mayor, just start your institute after you're done.
Yeah, just wait until you're done, baby girl.
Yeah, wait till you're done.
All of us are going to be rich if you do the communism well enough.
Mm.
All of us or none.
Interesting.
Oh, wow. Well,
that's my T. Dan Smith story.
Thank you so much.
When I started looking into this guy, I thought the most interesting thing about him was that he picked the T. Dan Smith name, because we don't really initialize first names like that. It's kind of Fed coded in American, but yeah, that's my guy.
God damn.
I'm so mad.
What a baffling and frustrating man.
Yeah. Huh. That was really tremendous. Thank you, Nova. Our longest ever episode.
I think so.
I'm so sorry.
You shattered the record. No, it was good. I'm glad.
It was because I had too many municipal roundups.
Yeah, I even spiked one for the show, which I guess we'll get to next week.
Well. Thank you so much for listening to the kind of lost dreams of a utopian north of England.
Yeah.
I'm sorry it didn't work out, but if you live in the north of England and you're sad, maybe you can get like, I don't know, like a protein bowl or something. You can get some gyoza.
We'll get them next time.
You probably make it all feel better.
Yeah, English-speaking world, we'll get them next time.
Thinking about the kind of lost futures of the sort of like central belts of Scotland, maybe I'm going to get myself like a burger that's named racistly because it's got kimchi on it from a place called like Slutty Wings or something.
That sounds so grim.
And then my house is going to burn down. So thank you so much for listening. We have a Patreon because socialism has yet to succeed,
right.
All of us have to pay rent. So please consider subscribing to that. I think the bonus episodes are really good.
They are. NoGodsNoMayors.com.
We take it in turns. NoGodsNoMayors.com. We hope to see you there.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of capitalism and also lost utopias, if it's the holiday season, and if you need a gift for a loved one, I have a book out called Simplicity that you can buy.
It's really good.
Anywhere books are sold, and you should get one, please, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You should do that. You should listen to all of our other podcasts.
Yes.
Riley and I are on Trash Feature. Mm-hmm. I'm on a bunch of others. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.